Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Quarterly prices for slaughter steers are forecast to average about $226.20 a hundredweight and $224.28 a hundredweight for the last two quarters of 2025. And $228.49 a hundredweight and $231 and a penny a hundredweight for the first two quarters of 2026.
University of Nebraska at Lincoln livestock economist Dr. Jason Franken.
For 600 to 700 pound feeder steers, prices are forecast to average about $346.36 a hundredweight and $347.02 a hundredweight for the last two quarters of 2025 and $356.87 a hundredweight and $356.21 a hundredweight for the first two quarters of 2026. These projections reflect tighter supplies and declining but still strong domestic consumption and export demand.
This is Agriculture Today.
Grain movement saw varied performance across transportation modes for the week that ended July 26. U.S. Class 1 railroads originating 25,155 grain carloads, down 9% from the prior week, but still 25% higher than last year and 26% above the three-year average. August shuttle railcar bids, $34 below tariff, $3 higher than last week, but $216 lower than the same week in 2024. Now, non-shuttle bids remained at the tariff rate, down $281 from last year. On the rivers, barge traffic rose sharply, barge grain movements totaling 843,450 tons. That was up 15% from the previous week and 28% higher than the same week last year. A total of 542 grain barges moved downriver, with 690 unloaded in the New Orleans region, up 16% from the previous week. And ocean freight also saw active loading as of July 24th. 26 grain vessels had been loaded in the Gulf, an 18% increase over last year. However, only 37 vessels expected to load in the next 10 days, that's 3% fewer than the same period in 2024. Shipping rates to Japan rising 3% to $54.50 per metric ton from the Gulf and holding steady at $29.50 from the Pacific Northwest. Finally, diesel prices edged down slightly to $3.805 per gallon. It is 3.7 cents above the same week last year. A new study from North Dakota State University, partly funded by USDA's Ag Marketing Service, examines how changes in the Black Sea region affect global wheat trade flows and logistical cost. The report highlights cost advantages tied to proximity, such as U.S. exports to Mexico, Australia, to Asia, and Russia to the Middle East. It suggests port logistics remain critical to export competitiveness. Now, one scenario shows that expanded Russian port capacity could reduce U.S. wheat exports by up to 875,000 metric tons. However, logistical constraints continue to limit countries like Ukraine and Argentina from gaining Chinese market share, even if phytosanitary restrictions are lifted. An easing of Russia's wheat export quotas would shift shipment timing and give Russia a larger global share at the expense of U.S. exports. In the meantime, domestic wheat logistics are also under pressure. Norfolk Southern Railway embargoed inbound wheat shipments to Arden Mills Flour Mill in Chattanooga, Tennessee. That effective July 25th, citing rail congestion. The mill, Tennessee's largest, also receives wheat by barge, but barge traffic is slowed due to major delays at the Kentucky lock, which was caused by nearby repair closures at a Barkley lock. And finally, according to USDA's Biennial Farm Technology Use and Ownership Report, more farmers turning to the internet for business needs. In 2025, half of all U.S. farms reported using the internet to purchase ag inputs, up 18% from 2023. In the meantime, 29% of farms use the internet to market their products, an increase of 6% over the last 2 years. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
What should we expect to take home if we have a calf butchered?
Dr. Mark Johnson, Oklahoma State University beef breeding specialist.
So we start with the concept of dressing percentage. Dressing percentage is basically the amount of hot carcass weight that we have relative to the live weight of the animal. For example, if we butchered a 1,500-pound finished steer today, and he had a 63% dressing percentage, the 63% times 1,500 means we have a hot carcass weight of about 945. Keep that one in mind, because as we go from hot carcass weight to chilled carcass weight, since a beef carcass is about 70 to 75% water, we're actually going to lose another 2 to 5% from evaporation as we go to that chilled carcass. So factor that in as another potential loss of weight. And then think about the concept of going from intact carcass to primal cuts to the subprimals and the actual retail cuts that we wrap up and are in meal-ready form. Now here, our basic breaking down the carcass process is done to eliminate most of the bones or skeleton out of that beef carcass, to actually separate fat from lean, thick cuts from thin cuts, tender cuts from those that got more connective tissue, and make these things more user-friendly to the point that we're ready to cook them and prepare them for a meal. And so there's loss associated with that along the way. And eventually, we get to that point, how much product are we going to take home from that steer? Well, we get into several factors that have got a pretty big impact. One of those is how fat is that carcass at the time we start breaking it down. Based on how much fat we trim off or leave on is going to influence our take-home yield as well. The degree of muscularity of the carcass is going to play a role. A heavier muscle carcass is going to be a higher yielding carcass in terms of take-home product. Think about this, for example, of a beef-type steer versus a dairy-type steer that we turned into a carcass. Muscle is going to be an advantage in terms of yield. Another thing that impacts us is just the cutting specs that we use or give to our processor in terms of how they're going to break that carcass down for us. Do we want all the fat trimmed off that's possible? Do we want certain cuts to be bone-in? Some people like bone-in ribeyes. A T-bone steak has got a bone left in it, but it could be turned into a fillet and a strip loin steak by taking that T-bone out. So cutting specs are going to influence our yield as well. In the end, what do we get down to based on some of these variables, some of these decisions we make in terms of cutting specs? If we take the live weight of that steer, general guideline is we should expect to take home about 42% of cut wrapped beef to put in the freezer. So back to our example, the 1,500-pound steer, about 42% of that works out to about 630 pounds of take-home product. Now, if we are working off the hot carcass weight of that steer, expect to take home about two-thirds of it. That same 1,500-pound steer, 63% dressing percentage, 945-pound carcass. The 945-pound carcass, by two-thirds, is also about 630 pounds of take-home product. So, whether you're buying a butcher steer, feeding out your own, at that point, that moment of truth, when it's time to take home the product that we're going to consume and we're trying to figure out how much storage and freezer space we need, use those rules of thumb. 42% of the live weight or two-thirds of the hot carcass weight gives us a pretty good handle for the actual amount of take-home product.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We are in a different time right now, and what I mean by that is it's more of a global marketplace than ever before.
Louis Barbera is the owner of VLM Commodities.
Not long ago, the United States was larger than the next five exporters in the world. That has now changed. We've moved down to number two, and we're slowly moving down that ladder. Brazil has seen a huge increase in acreage over the last couple of years, and it's been a shock to the market. And the biggest shock has come to the U.S. grower, because their harvest pressure is no longer 3 months when their own harvest is going on. Their harvest pressure is now 9 months with the double cropping of Brazil and then ours as well. You throw in South America, the Southern Hemisphere with Australia getting a consistent production, and India looking to become the world's largest grower by 2035, they say. It's been a huge transition, and we're getting to the point where the only thing that's going to save us is demand. And you touched on it where there needs to be a little bit more awareness on the benefits of cotton and the dangers of man-made fibers.
So what will it take to turn the market around?
A trade deal wouldn't hurt. Don't get me wrong. In the past, our rallies basically have been on the heels of China's state reserve coming in and trying to refill with several hundred thousand tons at a time. We've sort of transitioned, and I think a larger transition is underway with manufacturing swapping out of China. You know, most people look to China as the world's savior for cotton imports. Bangladesh is the world's largest importer right now. Unfortunately, they get most of that from Brazil and India. Vietnam is right behind them. In fact, China's a distant third behind both of those. Pakistan, because of their weather problems and their seed technology, have started creeping up as one of the largest importers. So yes, trade deals will help, but what will need to happen is you're going to have to dissuade the fast fashion industry from being such a large chunk of the consumption of apparel. If we could shift 1% of consumption away, that is equivalent to 5 million bales of usage. And it's really that tight. Our fiber share has seen a consistent drop for the last 15 years. We finally now are starting to get some awareness, and rightfully so, about the dangers to the environment, the dangers to our bodies for microplastics, and basically anything you're putting on your body or in your body that's made from petroleum. I'm not here to bash the petroleum industry. I mean, we need it, for goodness sakes, but that doesn't mean you have to layer your body with it. And I think that's going to be the largest contributor to cotton consumption going forward, and that is the way forward to rally. As of right now, you have growers in the on-call report that are the equivalent of 7 million bales that are sitting above the market to sell, and we expect those to start to be sold somewhere around 70 all the way up to 73 cents. That a large portion of that is from South America and some from Australia. That's going to be an anchor over us, and without the demand shift and the fiber share argument coming back into play, I think that we're going to be stuck for just a little while longer. There is legislation, the BACA, the Buy American Cotton Act, that could be instrumental in reviving the U.S. cotton consumption story. And I think that that's going to come up and be a little bit more at the forefront at the end of the year after Congress comes back and sort of gets their stuff together.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
For the last 20 years, we've been promoting distillers' grains coming out of American ethanol plants. And for the last 10 to 11 years, we've been developing foreign markets for ethanol, for American-made ethanol.
Ryan LeGrand is CEO of the U.S. Grains Council, now known by a new name.
In the case of distillers' grains, 2 decades. In the case of ethanol, a little over a decade. These products and the market development for these products has been part of our identity in practice, but not in name. So we wanted to bring the full portfolio of all of our products into our name, and that's what we did with the U.S. Grains and Bioproducts Council.
That vote held recently at a big annual meeting.
That's right. It was our 65th annual Board of Delegates meeting. We had that in Grand Rapids. It was very exciting. We had quite the reunion, quite the homecoming, I would say, I would call it. 19 of our past chairmen of the board were present, and dating all the way back to 1995 was the oldest tenure that we had. And then 2 of our previous CEOs were in attendance to help us celebrate this milestone and to help take us into the future with this new name.
The Grains and Bioproducts Council holds 2 major meetings every year. But for this one,
well, the main part of this meeting is to elect our new board. So every year in July, this is our 1 of 2 annual meetings that we do. In July, we have our elections. And so we elect a new secretary treasurer that will end up in 3 years' time as our chairman or chairwoman. And then we elect some at-large members and some sector directors as well. So all told, We have five new board members this year and just a great group of people. So that's a big part of what we do. This year happened to have the name change vote, which received overwhelming support from our membership. But we also dive into a lot of the work that we're doing around the world. We have what we call A teams or advisory teams, and they're broken out by product and by region. And so that gives a chance for our members to hear from the folks that are on the ground that are doing the work and provide input into our strategy and our tactics. So it's a great opportunity to bring everybody up to speed, let them have the opportunity to provide input, and also have our elections.
LeGrand at one time served the Grains Council in Mexico City, where he saw firsthand the opportunities for ethanol. Do those still exist?
This year, we're going to top 2 billion gallons of exports of ethanol for the first time ever, and that's for the marketing year that's ending at the end of August here real soon. So that's very exciting news, but we continue to push the frontier in places like Mexico where we're not shipping a whole lot of ethanol today. I mean, it's increased to around 60 million gallons, but if they were to open up E10 in Mexico, that's a billion-gallon market. And you know, just a real opportunity that we're laser focused on. Then India is one that has really adopted ethanol in a major way. They see the benefits. They're using it. They're at an E20 blend right now, and there's already talks of them moving up to E27 and beyond. So they've had a lot of success with their ethanol production. They're not importing any fuel ethanol today. It's everything that they import from us, and it's a big market for us, but it's all going into the industrial side. So we'd love to crack into that fuel market as well as they continue to grow and have aspirations for not only on-road fuel, but sustainable aviation fuel.
Ryan LeGrand, CEO of the U.S. Grains and Bioproducts Council. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Are cattle inventories turning the corner?
Dr. Jason Franken, University of Nebraska at Lincoln, livestock economist.
The USDA's July cattle inventory report estimates the total inventory on July 1st at 4.2 million head, down about 1.25% from 2 years ago, as the USDA didn't release the report last July. In its absence, a prior FarmDoc article estimated nearly the same size cattle herd for last July, which, if true, implies only less than a tenth of a percent further reduction over the last year. That July herd estimate reflects two main indicators of expansion and contraction, specifically the share of the cow herd slaughtered and the share in feedlots that are heifers, which respectively last dipped below 7% and 35% in 2015 and 2016 during the last expansion phase, and again are turning downward at 6.7% and 38.1% respectively. Hence, any slowing of herd reduction or even hints at expansion reflect increased retention or reduced culling of cows, as opposed to replacement heifers at this time. All cows and heifers that have calved total 38.1 million head, also about 0.75% below the prior July report, which reflects a 1.2% fewer beef cows at 28.7 million head and a 0.5% more dairy cows at 9.45 million head. It's the lowest mid-year cattle inventory since 2014, when herd rebuilding started following the drought in 2012, and the beef cow herd is the smallest on record. Led by the beef cow herd, both the total cow herd and overall inventory come in slightly above the range of pre-report expectations, with most other USDA estimates in line with expectations except the 2025 calf crop at almost 1.5% lower, which naturally also comes in just above the range of expectations, as do bulls over 500 pounds, which are unchanged compared to average expectations of nearly a percent lower. The latter may indicate producer sentiment regarding continued and perhaps increasing herd bull needs. Even so, the USDA confirms expectations for nearly unchanged dairy replacement heifers and about 2.5% fewer head in beef replacement and other heifer categories as well. Steers over 500 pounds and calves under 500 pounds are both down about 1.5% as expected. The USDA's most recent cattle on feed report indicates that feedlots placed 1.44 million head on feed and marketed 1.71 million last June, or about 8% fewer placements and 4.5% fewer marketings than in the prior June, bringing the July 1st total number of cattle on feed to 11.1 million head, or over 1.5% less than last July. The mix of steers and heifers indicates that almost 1% more steers and 5.5% fewer heifers are being sent to feedlots compared to a year ago. Still, as noted earlier, heifers comprise over 38% of the cattle in feedlots as compared to only around 32 to 35% during much of the last expansion. So producers appear to remain reluctant to expand the herd by retaining replacements at this time. With lower inventory and cattle on feed numbers, beef production in 2025 is anticipated to be almost 3% below last year and then drop almost another 1.5% in 2026. Accordingly, per capita beef consumption is expected to remain at 59.1 pounds per person in 2025 and then decrease another 1% to 58.4 pounds per person in 2026. Meanwhile, exports are projected to decrease 9.3% this year and 6% next, reflecting limited availability of beef and potential concerns for retaliatory tariffs. Cold stocks of beef remain fairly low and at the end of June are down 3% from a month earlier and 1% from a year ago. All things considered, high prices are likely to persist for quite a while.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Technically speaking, even though we've retreated in prices, it's gotten down to a level in these 980s, 990s that has provided support before. So I think it might get some attention from the technical traders who believe the market's going to sustain the range.
Soybean market spent six consecutive days lower. Corn, a couple of days lower. Bob Maurer, Manduca Trading, Chicago.
The weather has been favorable. Good soil moisture, average to warmer temperatures, some heat stress here and there like we know, but nothing major. So net, as long as you got some soil moisture that's adequate, it could offset dry spells or hot spells, shall we say, for a period of time. And I think that's what we've seen generally happen throughout the bulk of the U.S. So that's working its way as a bearish element in the market. In terms of global trade, demand dynamics, China's not committed to any new crop U.S. soybean purchases. And actually, they recently bought a third cargo of soybean meal from Argentina, which sends the signal that they're sourcing product elsewhere. I think probably, just in my humble opinion, until the dust settles and they can get a firm grasp on what the trade policy between our two countries is going to be over the intermediate term. Crush demand has been a positive element for the soybeans. June U.S. soybean crush hit a record high of about 197.1 million bushels. So domestically, we've got pretty strong demand from the processors. That's a good thing. However, soybean oil prices have started to fall back just a bit at the moment. And palm oil prices are also weakening. So if that continues, you might see the crush break a bit. But again, a one-off is not a big deal. We just need to see what the trend is going to be. Other than that, that's pretty much the main impacts in the soybean market. If we turn our attention real quick over to corn futures, again, kind of sounding like a broken record in terms of overall weather. It's been mostly favorable for corn also, and they kind of go hand in hand. Soil moisture is strong, like I mentioned. Weather hasn't been, in terms of the heat, hasn't been unbearable for long, long periods of time without that soil moisture there. So kind of offset each other a little bit there. There is some talk of some potential isolated yield losses, especially here in Illinois, from pollination issues because of the heavy fog and rain during tasseling. So we'll keep an eye on that, see if the high end of expectations in terms of yield might actually start to come off a little bit. But that said, some private yield estimates are actually climbing a bit. So if there is any kind of spotty yield loss, generally speaking, nationwide, on average, the market doesn't seem to obviously be pricing that in, because clearly, if the price in the futures market is an accurate reflector of all the fundamentals, we clearly see lower prices, so there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of concern at the moment. In terms of South America, Brazil's Safrinha corn harvest, it's about three-quarters of the way, give or take, complete. So that's almost done. And obviously that adds to the short-term global supply situation. Ethanol demand's been backing off a bit. June corn use for ethanol was a little bit disappointing, generally speaking. Had about 448 million bushels. So we would need that to at least stabilize, if not push higher, to create some kind of turnaround in the momentum of this market at the moment.
That's Bob Maurer, Manduca Trading. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Trade is very, very important. When our farmer members are polled, trade is always near the top of the list, right behind that the crop insurance, which is really their safety net. That's always going to be number one, I think. But a lot of times, trade is number two on those polls of their priorities. And within that trade is a subset.
Ryan LeGrand, CEO of the U.S. Grains and Bioproducts Council.
They want to see us marketing value-added products like distillers grains, like the high pro distillers grains that are coming out of our ethanol plants, and of course ethanol. So the idea there is to create that value here in the United States, create jobs here in the United States, and export that value add to the world. So we're following our members' priorities and heavily focused on expanding existing markets and finding new ones for the products coming out of the United States.